This is the Penobscot Bay Report. I'm Ron Huber. February 27, 2015, Casco Baykeeper Emeritus Joe Payne gave a talk and discussion at the Belfast Unitarian Universalist Church. Joe described his two-decades-plus career as Keeper of Casco Bay and gives his strong support for organizing a Penobscot Baykeeper. Joe suggested a unique affiliate-style Penobscot Bay waterkeeper program that reflects the enormous size of the bay and the different societies, economics, and ecology of the different reaches. This is part three of the recording. It's 16 minutes, 32 seconds long.
Let me switch gears to more waterkeeper. I'm available mostly, email. Anyone has questions, not to stop them or anything now at all about Casco Bay. We'll go on to that. But, I think it is a good model, or at least a story to look at. It's not that far away. It's right here in Maine. 24 years old. Very successful in achievements and in still being there and supporting itself 24 years later. And paying salaries. There are now 8 people on staff there. So it's a lot more than $100,000 now. It's closer to $700,000 a year to support that habit I had. But I want to talk about waterkeeper. And the story there is John Cronin was the first. How John Cronin got to be the Hudson River Keeper is because General Electric polluted the Hudson River and polluted it so badly with PCBs mostly that the fisheries were gone, or if they were still there, like shad are a huge part of the Hudson River fisheries were and are. They could catch them, but they couldn't sell them because you couldn't eat them. And they had shad roe festivals, which they still have. The Hudson River Keeper has one now, but I'm not sure if they still get the shad roe from away or not. But it was a big deal, and the fishermen were very excited by this, and they talked about, they had a meeting at Croton on Hudson, and they said, let's shove mattresses up that big pipe, back that shit up into their plant, and blah, blah, blah. And there was a guy in the audience who was part of them, a lot of ex-Marines there, and his name was Bob Boyle, and he happened to be the senior sports writer for Sports Illustrated. He still does write pieces for Sports Illustrated. But he said, hey, I found this law, the Rivers and Harbors Act of 1890 or something like that. And he says, it says if we report a polluter and we sue them and we win, we'll get half the fine. And they thought that was pretty cool, the revenge part of they get half the fine, plus they get half the fine, but stopping the pollution. And so he talked them out of civil disobedience, if you will, or sabotage, and to go the legal route. And they hired a lawyer, and they sued GE, and they won, and then they hired John Cronin to be, they said, let's pay it forward, I guess. Let's do this again, because that plant is not the only thing polluting the Hudson River. Right. And they hired John, who was a part-time fisherman. And that is history. I mean, that Hudson River Keeper is still there. They have, last time they had 25 people on staff. They have a very big budget. And the bottom line, the greatest news is that went from a trashed estuary to the only, they say, I can't tell you this is true, but I tend to believe them. It's the only estuary that is fully functioning as it was in colonial times today. All the species are there or back there. In reproductive numbers, in strong populations. Doesn't mean, that all the water quality is great or anything. No, but
it sure looks better, too.
Yeah, but they've been working and working and working and winning. And they have won an awful lot of lawsuits. That's typically how they move forward, is by lawsuits. And they've done innovative things around the law and Pace University and environmental law clinic. But they were the first. And then came Long Island Sound Keeper and San Francisco Bay Keeper and New York Harbor Bay Keeper. Delaware River Keeper, and then Puget Sound Keeper, and then Casco Bay Keeper. And the first seven of us met in 1991, and we thought we needed to do something more. That was really ad hoc. Like I said, Mike had a hat made and I'm the San Francisco Bay Keeper. In my case, Don Perkins asked John Cronin, the Hudson River Keeper, if he would come up and speak, and then if he would support. You had to get John's okay at that time. And John had to think about us extending the spectrum to not just litigation. But I'm very pleased that he said there's room, under this tent for that to happen. By 1993, we had talked about how to move forward. And so we formed, the first seven of us formed the International Alliance of River, Sound, and Bay Keepers. And we worked under that moniker until 1999, when Bobby Kennedy, who had been with us, beside us all along because he worked for Hudson River Keeper, he said he would step up and be president and help build what we then called the International Waterkeeper Alliance. And then since that time, it's gone around the world. And as I said, there's 240 on six continents. And when I came back from my first meeting with the other six waterkeepers at the time, I was incredibly excited. And I would say to anyone who I could call her that I just met six people that if you went around the country and you tried to pick out people doing the most astounding things for the environment, you wouldn't find six people who are doing more than the six people I just met. I still believe that. They were doing things that were thinking big. And I'm not saying that they actually were thinking that big, but it kind of grew into it. Mm-hmm. They'd start with one thing, suing GE, and it would grow and it would get bigger and bigger, and holy Moses, making case law for the United States. It's doing business, doing that. There have been several cases at the Supreme Court. And it's interesting that I'm telling you about the law cases because that's not what we did. But it is a tool. And 2 years or 3 years after I started, Lee Doggett, I don't know if any of you had met Lee, but a fine worked for the DEP, was their marine division. Her whole self was the marine division. But she said, for the first 2 years you were here, we were sure you were going to sue DEP. And I said, well, maybe I should have. But that reputation preceded me, and it helped me get things done because I didn't have to mention it. Other people would think, oh, shit, we're going to be sued now. So, and so that's there. It's a tool in the toolbox. But the money part, like I say, it works around the world. It works in places. Russia. Russia has no, as I understand it, this is secondhand information, but no culture of philanthropy. But it's working there. Even Australia, philanthropy isn't as common as it is here, but it's working there, and it works everywhere. I'm not saying there aren't tough times, not saying it's not tough when the economy collapses, but Casco Bay, and I know Penn Bay is the same way, is important to a lot of people. And we saw, when it was really tough a couple years ago, I know Kim and I, so there was, a list of people we donate our $1,500 to a year. Some of them fell off because, it was just tough. But they were enough people that we maintained our budgets at Friends of Casco Bay through that because the bay is important to people. And you can make it, people, a waterkeeper can make it more important to more people because a stupid, I think incredibly stupid thing that I shamelessly did take advantage of, is that visibility, meaning in the paper, on TV, on radio, is equated in the public's mind to credibility.
Yep.
Visibility is credibility. If they hear about you, unless it's in a bad way, I did work hard to not make that happen by only talking about things that I knew about and learning about things I felt I needed to learn about. But so working on getting in the paper, getting on TV, it turns out to be a really important part of the job. We make fun of one of my best friends and Kim and I's best friends as a couple. But the New York Harbor Baykeeper, Andy Wilner, there was an oil spill on Staten Island and there were dead birds and, oil in the water. And the TV people were talking to someone. And Andy said, "Put the camera on me." And you have to do that. know, you have to be in people's space. You have to say that. But he knew he needed to get out the part of the story he felt was important. And they were saying, well, kill Van Cullen. It's just dead anyway. He was saying, no, it's not dead. Come out with me next week on the boat. I'll show you it's not dead. And we'll go fishing. And we'll beach seine. And I'll show you this is a live place. But anyway, so you have to get in people's face, and when they know it, they'll love it, and they'll support, you know, what you're doing. But it's a choice how you build the relationships, you know, how you move forward, work with or just against. But I think that through as one's thinking about Waterkeeper, and that is you also have to sit down in living rooms with people who can write checks.
Yeah.
And are they apt to want to invite you to come to their house if all they hear is the negative stories instead of, you know, the positive things that we both accomplish and aspire to? So the Waterkeeper Alliance, yes?
Would it be fair to say that these groups take shape because the DMR and the DEP aren't doing an adequate job of regulating? And if so, how do you interact with those regulators?
I think that's a really good question. I don't say that because I always feel it's like pandering or something. But usually groups like, you know, Baykeeper or whatever, they spring up for two reasons. One is that agencies, federal or state or local, aren't doing their job, and it either makes people mad. It tends to make environmental lawyers mad. For me, it more hurts me, you know, on an emotional level, and on an equity deal, it hurts that they're not doing what they're supposed to do. So that's one reason that catalyzes. The other is something happens. An oil spill happens. Coal ash spill happens. Fisheries die off. You know, a billion fish washing up on the Delaware River. That motivates people. What happened in Casco Bay to catalyze Friends of Casco Bay was there was a report published in 1989 called Troubled Waters. And some people, well-known in our state, took existing data and they compared it to NOAA's status and trends program. And they said Casco Bay is one of the most polluted bays in the United States. When I came on board and investigated that, I was able to refute that and also point out that one of the things they based that on was a flounder liver that was just laced with bad stuff.
Yeah.
Turns out it was one flounder. That does not a case make. And it was caught outside Casco Bay. So it wasn't even in the bay, and even if it was one flounder, doesn't matter. But, well, it matters, but you know, say it doesn't make a case. But that's what incited Don Perkins to say, Max Helen not going to take it, and set up a public meeting. Put sheets of paper this size on phone poles in Portland and said, come to the First Congressional Church if you care about Casco Bay. And people did. They got a couple hundred people. So that's what started Friends. Those two, and it's those two things that do it. So
let me. What was the name of that report again?
Troubled Waters.
And how did you interact? How did you position those two?
So what I saw a big part of my job as being was, I called it finding the good ones. And I know some of them have left, unfortunately, but I know people at DMR don't bother talking to them because, you know, they'll smile, nod, nothing will happen. It won't leave the room. And I know people at DMR who will actually work to try to make something happen. And the same thing, I actually worked more with DEP than I did with DMR. It's the same thing. So finding the good ones. And it was the same in the potential polluter community, if you will. You know, and I hope you don't take this how I don't mean it, but I'm saying take the world of marina operators. There are marina operators who do a great job. Again, they have the potential to do lots of bad things because they're right on the water and they're generating waste products all the time, you know, from changing oil in boats and antifreeze and sinks and et cetera, et cetera. So long before it happened, before I had to deal with any marinas, I'm meeting marina operators and I'm dropping by whenever I can and I'm learning the good ones. You know, the ones that I feel I can work with.
And did you have enforcement power?
No, you all that we can shame, embarrass, sue.
So it would be a report. That has to you come can report from DMR.
DMR, DEP. I mean, it could be the sheriff, the local police, the Coast Guard. Mm-hmm. I got the Coast Guard. I just sounds fat-headed too, but I taught the Coast Guard that they actually had powers they didn't realize they had, and it's around sensitive habitat. Mm-hmm. And in all our bays, we have an enormous amount of mud bottom, and then we have some rocky bottom. And rocky bottom is tremendous habitat. Mm-hmm. And Coast Guard can protect special habitat. And so there was a ledge in Casco Bay that was being impacted by fish gully, and I got the Coast Guard to stop it. But, you know, first of all, you have to, again, have that relationship. Be able to go into the Coast Guard captain's office, to get into his office and say, hey, here's what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the trick. And I think that trick goes back to credibility. And in the back of their mind, I better meet with this bozo because it might be in the paper tomorrow or I might be in court tomorrow without ever telling them that. You know, that's how it builds. So I wanted to tell you this.